Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven. Hello, today I have the wonderful Richard Curtis with me. For those who don't know Richard, he's one of the UK's leading heelwork to music stroke canine freestyle handlers. He has successfully competed in heelwork to music, freestyle, doggy dancing, sheepdog trials and obedience. He won the Crufts Freestyle Final not once but four times, plus winning the international freestyle competition at Crufts more than once. If you remember Mary Ray on TV doing the doggy dancing before the Best in Show of Crufts, you may also remember Richard doing it with her as a team. He has also judged the Crufts Finals numerous times, and, I don't know whether he'll remember this, I attended one of his workshops with a very young Moss, a little cream Daxi, long-haired, about 11 or 12 years ago down at the dog training barn, I think it was. Moss came back a very round sausage that day from all the treats they had, but we both absolutely loved it. So, yeah, welcome Richard.
Hi there.
Hi. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your current dogs, like just who they are, breeds, things that you do with them before we kind of get stuck in?
Right, well, my only non-collie now, you know, when I was doing more freestyle, I would have had different breeds. But my sort of last remaining sort of freestyle dog is Little Betty, who is my little chihuahua cross, who is she's coming up 16 this year. Still very up for it, but considering she's, you know, nearly 16. But you know, she's obviously older. And, you know, she obviously taught me a lot because she was sort of the first little tiny dog to get up to Crufts. And it was my challenge to sort of try and get her there because I like to set myself challenges. And then the rest of my dogs, I'll have Herbie, who is, he's advanced heelwork to music. And he's done a little bit of freestyle, but he's a very excitable soul. And so heelwork to music sort of always suited him. And then the rest of my dogs are the collies that I use for sheepdog trialing, and they're all different ages and standards at the moment, from sort of a young dog I'm sort of training at the moment, who's just going to turn one, through to one of my sort of retirees who has trialed, but also I've done a sheepdog and duck display for the last, I don't know, 10 years or so. And she was one of those dogs that used to, and still does to a certain degree, herd the ducks. So it's sort of a range of ages.
Mm, sounds like it. Are you, like, from what I can see through socials and stuff, would you say that you're more sheepdog trials than anything else nowadays?
Yeah, it's what happened was I've been very lucky with my freestyle and the heelwork to music. You know, I've done reasonably well. And
better than reasonably well.
Well,
stop playing it down.
I'm one that always thinks, oh, I could do better. But something that's always fascinated me has been sheepdog training. And I lived in the middle of Southampton, you know, in my little three-bed semi. And I was sort of doing a little bit with Pogo, who won one of the Crufts freestyle finals. And I got to that age where I was like, I'm either going to do it or I'm not going to do it. And so that resulted in a move halfway up the country to Grantham, having never, ever been to Grantham in my life, never moved anywhere more than sort of 10 minutes from home. Well, having lived in Southampton, as I say, all my life. So it was a big change, but it was one of the best things I've done because I've got some land here. So that meant sheep. So and it's a little bit like with the freestyle. When I started with the freestyle, it's always nicer to be trying to climb the ladder than it is be at the top of the ladder-ish. I'll never say I was at the top, but, you have that pressure of staying there. It is immense. What's happened in the last probably, you know, I've always taught people, but it's really increased in the last 5-10 years. So I've sort of got to that stage. I'll never say I wouldn't go back to competing in freestyle, but I know how much time I put into those freestyle dogs. You know, I always say it was like my part-time job, training and doing those routines. They would take, you know, a sort of a year in development, and you were on that merry-go-round. You had to qualify, and then you had to go to the semi-finals, and then you'd go to Crufts, and as soon as Crufts is finished, you'd be back on again. You know, a next routine you're thinking of, and you're always trying to better it, etc. And I went through the different dog breeds. You might know I had a Portuguese water dog, I've had Wizzy, a cross poodle. I've obviously had little Betty as well as different border collies. And each of those was really for the thing to feed my love of just training dogs and needing a challenge. And so, you know, when I started doing sheepdog training and trialing, something's got to give. We've got to work, unfortunately, and we've only got a certain amount of time. And I'm very much somebody, if I'm going to do something, I'm like, right, and I throw myself in and I do it just like I would do with the freestyle and hear it to music. And I live it, breathe it. You know, I'm every spare moment of my life is dealing with the dogs. And so, you know, that's how it's come about. And of course, you know, I'm still finding my way, I would say, with the sheepdog trialing. And so when you make a progression and you have that feeling of, wow, you know, I'm sort of done a little bit better. Whereas when you're at the top, there's only one way you go. And, you know, to stay at the top and the work involved, I just haven't got the time to do the amount of work that I would have done, which I would do with the freestyle dogs, trying to do that with the sheepdogs and with the freestyle and hear watch music dogs. Plus, of course, I do enjoy teaching people it. So I almost get more pleasure now from seeing them go in the ring and do it and them achieve it, because I sort of feel like I've been there and done it. I'm lucky enough to have won it. And so now let's let somebody else go and have a little go and help them to get themselves to that level.
Yeah, I get that when you are coaching and helping people. That feeling of when they have success is almost just as good as when you've had a success. So that's how I feel when I'm helping people with rally and dog sports, like a lot lower level. But it's like, you know, like I've been a part of that. But at the same time, I've not had the pressure because it's not me in the ring.
Yes. Yeah. But there is still a certain amount of pressure. I mean, I would say sometimes I get more nervous watching them go in the ring than I do myself, because I'm willing them on to do it. And so it's a different feeling, but it's also that pleasing when they, you know, they do go out there and you know how much you've helped them to get there and the sort of journey they've been on. And with some of them, you've tried to keep them on the straight and narrow and not let them sort of charge off somewhere
else. Get distracted.
Yep. Yes. And, you know, start on some other whizzy move without getting sort of some really good foundations, you know. So.
But I think also with, when it comes back to foundations and stuff, it's only until you've made those mistakes yourself that you realise that when you see this shiny thing that you go, I'll go and do that. It's when you've experienced the fallout yourself when you're like, oh yeah, if I'd have actually stuck with the basics and got them good enough, this would have gone a lot smoother. But I think that kind of we all have to learn that lesson too, which obviously just nicely brings me round to, you know, mistakes, which is the whole point of this podcast. So what would you say is your biggest mistake in your journey with dogs? Or is there just lots of many minor ones? Like, start somewhere for me.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people you've interviewed that have sort of started with the same sort of thing, in that, you know, the mistakes you make at the start, you know, back many years ago now, having got a bit older. You know, I was 9 years old when I started training dogs, and 15 when I started teaching people at dog training classes. And the style of training back then and what you were sort of told was totally, well, not totally different, but different from many of the things we do nowadays. So obviously mistakes happened then, but more of a sort of now sort of mistake, not mistake, but say the last 10 years or so, I'd say my worst thing about myself is I'm a little bit obsessive, and that means I can be a little bit like, I train basically too much.
Mm.
And so it's because I say that dog training, say for me, is a bit like a drug. So when I've got a young dog and I'm training it, And no matter whether it's freestyle or sheepdog training, I have to be so very careful for myself and go, right, I'm not going to train that dog today. And you would think that's so easy, I tell you. But when you are addicted to that drug of training a dog and that drug high of when it does it for the first time, and it might only be a very small increment of what it did, and you come back in and you're all jolly and your partner thinks it's, gosh, what's happened, you know, but come back in and it's not gone well, not gone brilliantly, and then you're thinking, what did I do wrong, what should I do better, and all of that sort of stuff. But and so it's very easy to go and do things too much. And so in freestyle, the dog that helped me a lot to sort of make sure I didn't was my Portuguese water dog called Disco, who, if you did anything more than three times, she would go, yeah, whatever, I'm off, bye. Yeah, she just, like a typical, I call it typical non-collie. Up to that point, although I'd had West Highland White Terriers when I was very young, I then had a few collies, three collies I would have had. And so she taught me about being very clear on what I wanted, not doing too many repetitions, keeping things very short and tight. So she was probably the dog that helped me on my route. But I would still say even now, and it's even worse with the sheepdogs, because you're
because
working
they'll keep
with
going.
Well, because they naturally want to do it. It's not like a dog for a freestyle or hill wax music where you're going, okay, it's tired now, it doesn't want the food, or it's not so playing so hard or whatever. With the sheepdogs, it's that inherent in the genetics, and they want to do it and they will keep going at it. So it's very easy to go, oh, I'll just go out and do that again. And so, yeah, I would say my worst mistake is over the years, I feel like sometimes I've and that's not for the sort of negative effect really that much on the dog, because you know, they will, that sort of dog that I will have perhaps overtrained are the sort that are very quite high anyway. I was probably lucky that I had Disco when I had her, and she taught me a lot. Although I did start with terriers, and that taught me a lot about don't overdo it, Richard. You know,
so, you're gonna lose it. Lose your fingers, a toy, something.
Well, yeah, they would, like, if there's no food, then I'm not gonna do it, sort of thing. To a certain degree, when I was at that age, sort of 9 years old, so they taught me a lot, and I think it was better that I started with those terriers and then had a border collie when I was 18, because I see some people when they've had that brilliant dog, you know, that dog that's a, you know, switched on and really, and that's their first dog. And I always think, because then when you get a normal dog, as I call it, you know, that's like, do I want to do it? No, I'm not sure.
Yeah, they start to think every other dog is broken if it's not a collie.
Yeah, well, it's the attitude, you know, they will have had the first dog, it's got this attitude of, yes, what do you want? What do you want? I'll do it, I'll do it, do it. And then they go and get one that's like half of their original dog. And it's not got that same want or drive. And, you know, if you've got a dog there, no matter what breed, and, you know, you've got food or a toy, and it's just like going, yeah, yeah, what do you want? I just want that. And it absolutely mad for it. Then you've got that tool. But then when I see people then get a dog who is, yeah, I'm interested in that toy or treat, it goes, but and so then they've got to work hard, and then they find that's really hard to do, is to be active, to engage that dog, because they've never had to engage it, because they just have to stand there with a toy and the dog's going wide-eyed and mad for that toy. It was that, I'll do anything for that food or toy. And they are the sort of easier type of dogs to train. But I sort of feel like I was good that I started with Westies, because they weren't easy.
No, I can imagine. I think that's a really good point, actually, of overtraining. I know I've been guilty of it. I found myself when I got Ripple, which is my middle Dachshund currently, when she was tiny puppy, I was like, right, we're going to train and I'm going to film it for my clients and all of this. And I'd be like, yep, I know, only 5 minutes per time. We'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this. And then I checked my camera and I was 20 minutes in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay. And at that point, I just basically ordered now I use a timer on my phone, but I just ordered an egg timer because I was like, okay, 5 minutes, and that's going to stop me doing it. And the dogs know now, they hear the sound, and they're like, okay. Because I'm like that. I'm like, I've got a youngster. Oh my God, this is going to be brilliant. And I have to stop myself. Having never had a collie, it's very much, especially with Daxies, you know, you've got to have food because, you know, they're foodies as a general rule. Yes, some of them will be quite toy play based, but you've got to be able to motivate them. And, you know, I've worked with plenty of collies and I'm like, yeah, this is just so much easier. So I can see how people would get flat if they've started with a collie and go to a normal dog. But yeah, okay, cool. Any other mess ups, mistakes, regrets?
Well, I think it's a mistake every single dog trainer will make, even if we don't think we do, and that is the one more time disease. And it is a disease, isn't it? It's like, you've done two brilliant ones, and I say to people, look, you've just done two, stop, don't do any more. And they're like, but shouldn't I just do one more? And can I just do one more? And I was like, why do you want to do one more? And it's probably back to disco again and having these like non-collies. It really like refines what you do with the dog and makes you think about what you're doing with the dog, and you make sure you leave it on a win, even if it's like having to go back steps. You know, Disco and probably many of my dogs have always taught me about, yes, pushing on a little bit, but never be afraid to go back umpteen steps in what you're teaching. But one more time disease can kick in when you want the dog to do it. Realizing that just leaving it, if it's done it brilliantly once, you know, the beauty about freestyle is there is so much else you can do. So if the dog does do it brilliantly, there's so many other moves, I like to call them moves, but people would call them tricks, that you can go to. So within a session, it could be, you know, 5 minute session, but that there's so many things you can just sort of have a little go at without then making it boring for the dog and keep going at the same thing. And, you know, again, when I'm teaching, I'm just trying to stop people. And it's something I do in classes. I know some trainers, they'll give something for the handlers to do and then they send them off and they all do it. And sort of 20 minutes later, this dog's done about 1,000 repetitions of whatever move. Whereas with me at my classes, I try and train them how I would do, which is you do a little bit of that and then we move on. We do a little bit of this. We might come back to it, but it's very sort of not fast and furious, but it's like, I don't want them to stay at it for more than, you know, a few repetitions, because they're just going to bore the dog. And then the dog, you know, it will get past that stage of learning and it then starts the bad habits starting. So it's really important to try not to do the one more time.
Yeah, oh, I totally agree with you there. And yes, I have been guilty of that. And it's rife amongst dog trainers, definitely. And going back to what you were saying about that you kind of put everything into whatever dog sport you're in at the time, but you put everything into freestyle and heelwork music. When, I mean, Moss is 13 and a half now, and I brought him to one of your workshops when he was like, I don't know, a year, something like that. And I've got a real interest in it. And I'd kind of, you know, I'd looked at some videos online and I'd been watching a few competitions I'd been and kind of attended. And I thought, is this going to be for me? And I absolutely loved that day. And the reason why I never actually properly dipped my toe in is because I knew I would get obsessed and I knew my life would be that. And yeah, I'm not saying never, because I think at some point I probably will end up there because it's always appealed to me. But I also knew that realistically I couldn't afford that time and energy to just focus on that when we already had Rally and bits of obedience and things like that. And I'm still a decade on and not in a position to go, I'm going to give up everything else so I can focus on this. So yeah, and I also get very obsessive when my life for a long time was just Rally and everything was Rally. a bit more relaxed about things, but I have more dogs to train, so I can't put everything into one, and that's just that's the way it is, as well as trying to make a living, as you say. So, okay, before we move on to any more mistakes, just because I'm going to ask this, you mentioned your little old now Chihuahua and training her. Any tips for small dog training?
Yeah, I mean, Betty is very tiny and obviously fills up very quickly. So she was the dog that made me learn about, I call it flappy chicken. So flappy chicken.
Or Corinne would call it dangly ham. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So mine has always been flappy chicken because Betty, obviously little, so she fills up very quickly. And so the very, very cheap, horrible circular chicken roll that you buy, of course, it's a lot of it. It's water. But the other good thing is it's white, and so the dog can see it when it's higher up. And so if you've got that tiny treat in your hand, she's all the way down there. How does she know, you know, when you're starting off training her? And the other good thing about the flappy chicken is she made an effort chasing after me, running away with it like a little tuggy toy or wiggly worm. She could grab it, and she might grab it, and she might get a whole massive piece, almost sort of like a jackpot. And so it really made her shift it. I would certainly say making sure that you don't neglect also that attention, because just because they're down there doesn't mean that they have to look at your feet. And so making sure that they are 100% attention and looking at certain things that are, because they've got little legs, they are nearer to the floor. So with little Betty, I spent a lot of time on, if there's food on the floor, she wasn't to eat it, she had to ignore it. And that was important for just things like a little bit of leaf or something that was on the floor when we would work. And she's very, very foodie, little thing. And so it was quite hard for her to do. Like, you know, I'd sort of put a handful of kibble down in the lounge, and I'd walk around it, and she had to pay 100% attention. Obviously, I'd build it up gradually, etc. But, you know, I then didn't throw food for her. So a lot of people throw food as a reward. But with her, I very, very rarely would I ever throw food. And I'd always pick her up after she'd worked, especially if I was at a venue, because I don't want her going off round finding bits of food, rewarding herself. And so, you know, I see some people throwing food with a little tiny dog and then sort of ignoring it, letting it go off, and it has a nice picnic going around the venue. I'm a bit of a control person. But, and so, you know, I'm like, I'm always trying to look in my crystal ball and what problems do I don't even want to start. So with her, you know, I was very conscious of making sure that she didn't go off and find food, because she probably would have been off and searching for it, and, you know, not thinking that she had to look at everything that was on the floor. So those are things. And then, you know, just don't get a little dog when you're old. That's what I say. I mean, I'm
not
so
even old and I get a bad back training.
I was going to say, I mean, I'm lucky I had a, you know, much earlier, 16 years ago, I was a lot younger. And I'm thinking, God, all that leaning over now, I was like, I'm not sure. Because, you know, doing just like little bits of heel work with her, I mean, she's not higher than my ankle, really. So it's like, and people say to me, oh, is there another way you can do it? Using a target and this and that and the other. And yes, you can do it to a certain degree, but if you want close heel work, you've still got to be down there, you know, and reward. Yes, you can sort of do the heel work, but if you want really close to your leg, you're going to have to be down there with your hand. So yeah, bad backs are one that you can get with the little dogs.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a young Labrador at the minute, and I used to have a flat, I've got a retriever as well. But I having not had a big dog for a number of years, and then the Labrador coming along, it's been lovely. I'm like, oh my God, I don't get a bad back. This is brilliant. But it's always been the Daxes I've had in dog sports more than any other breed, and I'm like, why do I do this? Because my back is in bits.
Yes, yeah, it's not good. And I mean, yes, you can raise them up for teaching certain things, but yeah, it's a lot of, with Betty, it was a lot of being down. I do another thing called chase the rabbit, which is basically the food in my hand and racing away and being very active. And that's one thing I would say when I'm teaching, that a lot of people aren't active enough with their dogs. They're not interactive enough with their dogs. They're a little bit like feed it a treat.
Food
That's it.
dispensers.
It's like, whereas it's so important that you are moving around, you are not just using that food, but entwining that food with a whole attitude of wanting to be with you, chase you, and that whole sort of training experience. I think the use of food nowadays is great, but some people do rely on it as the dog's there going, yeah, I'll do it. You've got the food in the hand, and the
It's a
hand's not,
crutch.
yeah,
Yeah.
then well, the handler's not saying anything, and it doesn't matter because the dog's just going, yeah, you've got the food there. But then as soon as you go into something like freestyle and hear its music, you've got like a crutch, you've got 4 minutes, you've got to be in that ring, and it is very hard, as you know, with a dog that is foody to try and get it to do 4 minutes and no end of tricks within like little Betty's routine, just to keep her going for 4 minutes without going, God, I haven't been
Where's my treat
rewarded.
now? I've done a few tricks. Where's
Yeah.
my treat? Yeah.
Which is why I think freestyle and hear-what's music is one of the hardest sports, because there is A, so much you've got to teach, B, you've then got to proof it all, C, you've then got to try and like attach it all together. And meanwhile, you've also got to try and keep the dog's attitude and convince it to keep working in the expectation of food coming if your dog is only foody sort of motivated. And so that's really quite hard. But on the plus side, in freestyle, there's no required moves. So you can really look at what your dog likes to do. And so I've always built my routines around things the dogs like to do, because I always feel like I'm going to be able to get that under a pressure situation. There's other sneaky little things you can do as well. Like with Betty, her routine had a little thing that she got into, pretend briefcase, and she got into, and I actually she taught her to jump into it. She could jump out at any point, but she was taught to stay in it, and then I could move her part way across the ring, and then she'd jump out again and back into a leg weave. And so little tricks like that, which saved her energy but still made it look like the routine was, still
Planned
carried
in,
on and
yeah.
everything.
I have so much respect for people in the sport, massively. And I've always viewed it as something that, well, one, I know that my training isn't clean enough as yet. And I do think that you need to have very, very clean training for it. And then also being able to, I say regularly, but often change the cues for the same behaviours, and never mind the creativity of the routines and, obviously your costume and things like that. Just have a lot, so much respect for it. And I, from what I can see from the outside, it is, so that's got to be the hardest sport. Totally.
And it's, you are, unlike some sports, you are out there on your own, and you could have like 100 people standing watching you. Whereas, an obedience show, or I don't know about rally, but
Not spectator sports.
you'd have some people standing out there, but you're not going to have 100 people at every show, or at least, 30, 50 people standing watching you. You're out there, you're on your own. And then there's that whole thing of you haven't got a steward, or you haven't got, in the case of rally, that sign to tell you what you're meant to do, in case you've forgotten. It's like it's all got to be in your head, and you've also got to try and time it all with the music, because the music, there might be that lyric there that you need to hit, and that's, where your musical interpretation is coming in. So you've got to have one ear on the music. You've got to be telling the dog what to do, but also with most dogs, you've got to motivate it as well, because, if you just can't start barking commands at them, then they start turning off. So With little Betty, I had my little secret sort of sounds that she was conditioned to, which sort of meant keep going and normally you're going to get a reward, but in certain situations she would still keep going. But it would give her, it was like putting her up, kicking her up another gear, you know, because I could make these sounds that she had an expectation of what they meant. And so there was a lot of those going on in Crufts, I can tell you. In order to keep her going so that she zoomed it and kept that sort of attitude throughout the whole routine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Thank you for that. Have we got any more kind of mistakes, mess ups, thoughts on anything like that? Doesn't have to be dog sport related.
Right. I mean, it's so very hard to sort of sometimes think about things, you know, sort of things when you were, and you say sort of mistakes. And I sort of thought probably a lot of the things I pick people up on now are not necessarily mistakes I've made, but things I've learnt, I suppose, more than mistakes. And whether that means they were from a mistake, I don't know. And so within freestyle, with many moves, one of the things I pick people up on is giving commands too early in training, you know, and you get it in any dog sport when you're teaching something new. But one of my things is always to get the action and then put the command to it. But the amount of times I'm hearing, you know, weave, and this is on day one, the dog's never done a weave before in its life. It's now dancing around the front of the handler as the handler's saying it for the fifth time. And the dog's going, "Hey, I haven't got a foggy." She could say, you know, whatever.
Bananas. Yeah.
Yeah, bananas. And I still don't know what you're meaning. So, you know, using your commands only when you know your dog is sort of going to be able to do that action is something that I'm always picking people up on. And then we go the other end, which is people then over commanding. So when you want in freestyle, we want the dog, say, to circle an object. It's very easy to get in that habit of, you know, circle, 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 circle as the dog's going around the object. And it's like, yes, that is to a point when we're starting off, you're naming the action. But then at some point, you've got to go, right, the action is you're going to circle that and you're going to, you've been told to circle it, you're going to circle it until you're told otherwise. So half of it, I think, sometimes is us. You know, why are we saying it again and again? We're saying it again and again because we feel like we should say it again and again. But what I'm always trying to do is get the dog to do that action to the command without anything extra, so that I'm not having to... Well, I'm giving the dog something, not giving the dog something that it's not going to have. As in, if I've said weave, 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 and then suddenly I go in the ring and go weave and nothing else, it's, you know, just, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't work.
No, so I'm always trying to get people to think about how and what they're training and the commands that they're giving. Because it also, from a freestyle point of view and a Hear It's Music point of view, it's like so much cleaner to see a routine where somebody goes weave and the dog goes in. And to a certain point, you know, with certain ones of my moves, the dog's just learning on a body signal. So there is many handlers who do give commands a lot during sort of nearly every leg. It's like weave, 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 weave. But I just think it distracts from that feeling of sort of team oneness. You know, if you've got somebody shouting commands at the dog and you can hear them when I'm judging, you know, I don't like to hear people sort of twist at the top of their voice. No. You know,
takes away the magic, like you say.
That's right. Yeah. And so, but that all comes back to sort of how you train it from the start. You know, and we've touched on another one of my like things I rant on, which is about foundations. You know, that some people say, "Oh, Richard, he never moves me on," you know, because I'm like, well, you can't send the dog round without moving your hand around, around, around. Yeah, because if you get good foundations, you've got so much you can build from those.
Mm-hmm.
But within freestyle, it's so easy to get sucked into, let's get the dog vaulting off me and doing this advanced move and that advanced move. But the dog can't, you know, sit and hold something, Gordon. That's, I mean, even less than that. It can't twist on command without a big hand signal, say. You know, that's a very foundation move, just a spin or twist. But we should be able to do it on vocal command without the hands going mad, because it's just going to look so much more professional. But also when we do start to want it at a distance, we've trained it to a higher level than, you know, we sort of could have done if we'd stayed with our hand, and then the dog's reliant on that and everything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, foundations are one of my key things. And also within freestyle, it's not starting things formally too soon. So, you know, obedience, yes, you know, I'd start with my young pup, but I'm always saying about sowing seeds. So it's sowing seeds for moves I want later on. So I'll get the dog going through my legs and all of that sort of stuff, but I'm not gonna like formally teach it a leg weave, say. You know, it's like a young dog that I've got, he's actually my present sheep, the young nursery sheepdog I'm working at the moment. He's actually sort of dual purpose. He's learned a lot of the tricks when he was younger before I sort of started him too much on the sheep. And so he could do it. But, you know, I didn't name the weave probably until he was probably 8 months old. He could do it with a bit of help. And so I knew I got it, but it was no point in sort of putting it there necessarily, the command. And so, you know, with something like a weave, and I see it a lot with people who've had a freestyle dog, say they've had one, and then they get their next dog. And I think that's the one of the problems is when you get your second dog, because you know now stuff, you do stuff a lot quicker with the second dog and earlier. And you didn't do it with the first dog. Yeah. So with that first dog, you might have done more obedience because you went to pet dog club and you did it. Then you discovered a bit of freestyle, you know, when the dog was a year old or something, and then you started having a go. Whereas when you've then done the sport a bit with that one dog, you then get the second dog. And so, but now you know about these tricks and everything. So you start them a bit early. And so I must admit, my heart sort of goes a bit when I see like a 15-week-old puppy, like, and the person's going, look at my dog, it does a leg weave, woo, woo. Because I'm now, from experience of training so many people and seeing so many dogs, I sort of think, oh dear, 2 years' time, that dog's probably going to be barking in the leg weave because it's a very fast collie, you know, and it's getting lots of rewards. And you know, if you've got a young pup there doing a leg weave at 15 weeks old, you can bet your bottom dollar the handler will then do it a lot because it's the thing the dog can do. So yep. They like to
show
off. And
it makes them feel good.
That's right. And yep. So they do it even more. So by the time the dog's a year old, it's like, thinks the leg weave is very highly motivating. And so rather than going, okay, I've got my leg weave right now, I might not do it for a few months, which is what I can do, they'll like keep going at it and at it because it's really the only thing the dog can sort of do. It's only got a few things the dog can do. So by the time the dog then gets in the ring at 2 years old and you sort of then also put some spins and jumps and all those really highly motivating things for a fast dog, of course, it's been rewarded a lot in the leg weaver, so you sort of start getting a bit of noise. So I always sort of put caution into people when they've had one dog and then they get the second dog. I go, make sure you sort of sow your seeds, but don't overtrain things too early, because the more early you do stuff, I seem to find it goes downhill, you know.
Yeah.
And starts bad habits.
Yeah. And I think that's quite a common theme. I know I've done it and caught myself doing it years ago. If what makes you feel good, you practice the things that you don't need to practice, you know, with your dog, because you know they can do it and it makes you feel better. And you've got a quick win and the dog's got a quick win. When actually you're not improving anything, you're just doing the stuff that makes you both feel good rather than progress, which is really the whole point. Yeah, I've seen it also. I've seen it with in other dog sports as well, where so you know someone's got the second dog, they're like, yeah, I've got a tiny puppy, look at what it can do, and I'm like, please just don't. Please just don't. Just calm it down. But yeah, I think again it's all things that you learn along your journey.
Definitely, yes. You know, it's you just I suppose the number of dogs as well you train, and every dog is so different. The key thing I'm always saying to people is read your dog. It's very easy to say like a trick. It's like, right, so this is how I do it. And that's not always the way you did it with your last dog, taught it may not be the right way for this dog. And so you've always got to, you know, as a teacher myself of it, it's like I've always got to have umpteen sort of ways of doing things. And I'll often say to people, look, I tell people not to do this at all, and I'm going to tell you to do it because it's
They're good for
right for
this
that
dog.
dog,
Yeah.
you
Yeah.
know. And so it's for me, it's really important when I'm teaching that I sort of have my crystal ball. Because you know that's where I've trained that many dogs and seen that many dogs in my classes and well, you know, workshops and that you can recognize the signs of what you might get if you keep going down that line. And it's much easier to stop something before it starts. So you know, I had one lady come to me and got a young collie, and she was getting so excited because the dog was, say, circling an object. And you know, the voice would go higher and the dog's tail was going and its eyes were like popping out because it was like zooming around this thing. And I'm like, right, don't train that move, stop. Because you know, it's you could just see it's only, say, I don't know, 7 months old. You could see that in the crystal ball, you think, well, 2 or 3 years' time, that dog's going to be like whoop, wound up. And, you know, come back to that voice tone and all of that sort of stuff as well. So there is so many things, you know, you have to be aware of.
Definitely. Okay, I think we're going to start wrapping it up. I've loved this. So, can you tell the listeners kind of what you're offering at the minute, where they can find you, all of that kind of stuff, please?
Yeah, well, mainly at the moment, workshop wise, I do monthly workshops at the IABTC place at Haxey. I don't know if
Yeah,
you know it.
Doncaster. The
Doncaster,
Doncaster, yeah.
yes. I do have two groups up there that I do, and I have a group down in sort of Northampton way. Those are my regular sort of monthly workshops. And then because of the nature of
And that's freestyle and Hillworks
Hill
music.
Works and
Yep.
Music, yeah.
Yep.
Day-long workshops, as I say, every month. And then due to the nature of the sport, it's very individual, as in a routine is just according to your dog. So it's not something like you can all do. And so that's why a lot of people come to my place here at Grantham, and we do a lot of one-to-one training or via Zoom if those people that are a bit too far away. So tomorrow morning I'm off to Australia for an hour. It's very nice.
Yes.
I don't have to go. You know, I've luckily been invited to many places and gone there, you know, a couple of times to Australia to teach it. But nowadays it's actually quite nice to sit here and be teaching in Australia for you know
An
the
hour
morning.
without the 24 hours travel.
Yeah. So, and what with the individual lessons, and then I do a little bit of online stuff as well. That sort of keeps me very busy at the moment.
Can imagine. And how do people find that?
Through my website, which is K9, that's a K and a number 9, freestyle.co.uk, or just search on Facebook. It's K9 Freestyle and Hill Action Music with Richard Curtis. I've got a page there.
And I'll put those links in the show notes for anyone so they can just go and click and follow it through. But yeah,
Brilliant.
thank you so much for coming today. I've genuinely really enjoyed this, and obviously I've got to talk about Hillworks music, which I'd love to do one day, but it's just not the time yet. But I
No,
think we've
you're.
covered some great stuff for the listeners. Sorry, go on.
Yes, you'll get there eventually. The pull of having a little go will get you. So
yeah
you never know, we might get you in the ring at some point.
we'll see, we'll see. But yeah, okay, cool. I'll leave it there for the listeners, and we will be well I will be back next week, and I will speak to you all soon. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again, and we'll be back next week.